repeat something I said last night because we mean it and we mean it sincerely. Your committee are very, very grateful for the support that all you people have shown by turning up here. Many of you have travelled a great expense and have taken a long time getting here. Some of you have even come via Germany and Spain and other places. But you made it. Now that you're here, we hope you'll enjoy yourself. Now, before I introduce some people who were not here last night, there are just one or two things that I would like to tell you that you ought to know. This hall was completed a matter of 4 days ago. All through this year, Mr. Learmont, the manager, has been promising that if it were ready in time, we would have it. But he wasn't going to commit himself, so therefore we didn't commit ourselves. Now, I think I'm right in saying that this is the only hotel in London with convention facilities such as you've got here. Everything on stage, microphones, lights, music, curtains. Would you like to operate the steps for them? Steps go in and out at the press of a button. All this is done from the projection room up the back. Anybody who's really interested in the electronics, if you speak nicely to the projectionist and buy him a drink when he's off duty, he might very well show you around. But I think you'll agree that Mr. Learmont and the hotel in general have done us proud with our convention hall. And I, for one, am very grateful. Now, any of you coming in costume tonight, we would like to have details of your costumes, characters that you're depicting, in the committee rooms, please. If there's nobody there, just slip them under the door and we'll collect them as we go in and out. Now, this must be done by 4 o'clock this afternoon at the latest. Otherwise, Arthur Thompson, who is going to compare the show, won't have a clue who you're supposed to be. You're probably going to depict something from a story he's never even heard of. So would you please try and get that done? And anybody you happen to be talking to, in case they're not here, will you also tell them that if they're coming in costume to do this part? Another thing I must ask you to do, particularly people this is their first convention, please wear your lapel badges at all times. This is your receipt for your money. If you don't wear them, I'm just likely to charge you all over again. I'm from Scotland, remember. Now, through the back there is the convention lounge. Tea and coffee are available there all day on order. Tea 1 shilling, coffee 1 and 6. If you drink tea or coffee in any public part of the hotel, you will pay the full hotel rate. 1 and 6 for tea, 2 shillings for coffee. This service, unfortunately, is not available to us during the night because of shortage of staff, holidays and whatnot. But there is a coffee shop open all night. This too is for your benefit. There's also a bar, as you may have noticed, in your lounge. This closes, I think, about 10:30. But the bar outside in the hotel proper, that opens, what time is it? 12, I think? So you're well provided with liquid refreshment. You've got no excuse for not talking the entire weekend through. I think that's all the notices I have for you. And if there's any queries, you can always come down to room 131 or to the registration desk, and the committee will do their best to help you. Now, I quite honestly don't know who's here. A great feature of these conventions is that you have an ambition to introduce people and you find they're not out of bed yet. Hang on a minute. I can't see them. Yes, no. Don't you look horrible, folks, are you? I can't even see anybody I know. Ah, now there's somebody that wasn't here last night. Mr. J.W. Campbell. Now, while we've got him on the hook, I must tell you that Mr. Campbell has very kindly agreed to talk to you this weekend. As a matter of fact, all he's got to do is to go up and say, I think. You shut up and let him talk. Is that a deal, think you'll do it?
Generally speaking, I like to quit after the first 12 hours or 16 hours.
Oh, well, you should be pretty fresh. You've had it easy up to now. Gosh, these glasses are handy. Trouble is, everybody's still in bed. Is Archie Mercer in the hall? I can't see him. Archie, are you in the hall? Apparently not. That's what makes introductions such an exciting thing, you know?
Bob Silverberg.
Who?
Bob Silverberg.
Is Bob Silverberg here? There's Bob Silverberg. Mind you, we called your name last night and you weren't here, Mr. Silverberg.
Where were you?
Boozing?
Down the bar.
I thought so. There are so many people here that we have to introduce to you, but as I say, I don't know where they all are. No, British fandom. I don't know how well we're represented. John Rawls, is he up?
No,
I'm not. Zero's here. Archie Mercer isn't here. I do know who is around, though. Ken Bulmer. Ken, where are you? He's hot. All right, I'll go through the list. We'll just put your hands up and say here. Ted Forsyth, is he here?
I didn't see him.
Phil Rogers isn't here either. Ken Slater. We made one. Now, room number 151 and 152. Books galore.
Filthy huckstering.
Open on and off all during the weekend. In fact, it's closed only for meals and program items that Ken himself wants to listen to. And he will sell you anything he has in stock. Two copies of each, if you like. Right, Ken?
Correct.
James Cawthorne. He's in the hotel. I've seen him. James White. From Northern Ireland. One of our better authors, and I don't mean in person. Also amongst us, if he's in the hall, is Bob Shaw. I don't know if any of you have read Hyphen. Bob has been published professionally as well, but he is much better known, I think, for his articles in Hyphen, which are extremely sensitive pieces of writing. But he doesn't seem to be in the hall either. Later on this afternoon, naturally, after the introductions, Walt Willis will also be here. That's a name that a lot of you will know, although you may not have met him before. Ted Carnell, I don't suppose he's up yet. No. And Ted Tubb hasn't got here yet. Now these are all people that will be around the hotel during the week. During the weekend, rather. So if you see their names on the lapels, just you buttonhole them. Now it's time I go off here and left it open for the next item, which is a fan panel. Thank you very much for your attention. See you.
Now, this year we have put on the 6th fan art show at the World Conventions. And we've just finished the judging, and I'd like to announce the winners of that. Before I do, however, I'd like to say a couple of words. Now, this is the first time we have put on the art show in Britain, or outside of the United States. We have a number of pieces in there that are up for bid. The minimum bids are priced. Those of you who are interested in bidding on any of the artwork that's up for bid will notice there's a little green bitch up by the artwork. Simply sign your name and the price you're willing to bid. At noon on Monday, we will close out the bidding. The person who has the highest bid as of noon on Monday will be the person who has the right to buy that artwork. If you're anxious for a particular piece, you might show up at noon and you could outbid the top bidder. Of course, he may be there too and will hold a voice bid on those items and run them up as high as they go. Now, there is quite a bit of artwork on the sketch table. That's all for sale. The prices are marked. Ted Forsyth has been in there. He spent about 6 hours translating everything from dollars to sterling. And I hope that those of you who can will go through the work on the art table. We'll certainly go in and take a look at the show. Some of these artists have turned out some very fine pieces indeed. We had four judges for the artwork. Don Wolheim, who's just come in the hall at the back, John Bruner, Ted Forsyth, and Thomas Schlupp were the judges on the art show. In the category of science fiction illustration, first prize went to Eddie Jones for At the Tips. Second prize to Jack Wilson for the Plattner story. And third prize to Michael Jakubowicz for The Streets of Ashkelon. In the category of fantasy, first prize to Joni Stopa for The Mermaid. And second prize to Eddie Jones for The Undead. In the category of the Fellowship of the Ring, there was no first award, but there was an award of an honorable mention to Eddie Jones for A Map for an Adventure. In cartooning, first prize to Arthur Thompson, Ixpril's Acme Repairs. An honorable mention to Yoshio Ikamori, Reverse Limbs, Primitive Men. Astronomical art category, the judges had a real go-around. They could not decide between any of three paintings, and so the award goes to Eddie Jones for The category of experimental art, Cynthia Goldstone for The Gilgunis. And an honorable mention to Jean-Claude Rault for two pieces, Winds and Stone Desert. The category of children's fantasy goes to Jim Cawthorn for the illustrations from the stories by Alan Garner. And an honorable mention to Tony Glynn for the illustrations from Wind in the Willows. Most promising of show, Michael Jakubowicz. The open award to William Rotzler for Warrior and Our Hidden Self. The judge's choice for the award, which the judges felt was the best item in the show, Eddie Jones for At the Tips. There were no entries in the photo salon this year, and there is still one award to be made, and that is the award that you people will make, the popular vote award. There are, is a ballot box in on the desk in the art showroom. There are slips of paper by that ballot box. This is the chance for you people to go in and to vote for the award for the painting in the entire show which you like best. Now, this evening, at the close of the art show, we are going to go through and count those votes to determine a preliminary slate of candidates, and then tomorrow, among those nominations, we will have votes for the final award. So get in there, take a look at the art show, and vote for your choice for the popular vote. Thank you very much.
We have this afternoon a transatlantic science fiction quiz with the United States against the world. On my right is the United States, or selected portions thereof, consisting of Rory Ackerman, Jim Blish, Wally Weber, George O. Smith. On my left, representing everybody else, Sid Bounds, Jimmy Groves, Tom Schluck, Ken Cheslin. The way this works is very simple. I have a list of prepared questions. I even have some prepared answers. I will be firing them alternately at the two teams. They'll have 15 seconds to answer on any given question. If they can't answer, the question goes over to the other side. The scoring is done by Doreen Parker. And at the end of however long we have, I think it's 45 minutes, we'll have the score, and there will not be a prize, although several have been offered. The questions, by the way, were prepared by Ken Slater. First question to the anti-American team. What was the title of the first British professional science fantasy periodical to exceed three issues?
That was one.
No.
Scoops.
Too late. We'll take that as a miss. Tales of Wonder was the second one. Scoops was the first. Second question to the American team. One of the best known of the modern satirical science fiction novels is The Space Merchants by Fred Pohl and Cyril Cornblatt. By whom is the story told? What is the name of the character who tells the story?
Is Fred Pohl at the house?
Question goes over to the anti-Americans. It says right here, the hero won't do as an answer. The answer is Mitchell Courtenay. Two misses, back to the Americans. Many of the science fantasies of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle featured Professor Challenger, such stories as The Lost World. Can you give the name of the reporter who was often Challenger's companion? John Hurt is not right. The anti-American. He was an Englishman.
It was
Ed Malone of the Daily Gazette. So far, we aren't giving our scorekeeper any work.
We're asking her our questions.
Here's a more recent one for the anti-Americans. In both the Medship series and the Colonial Survey series, Murray Leinster has made use of one particular item of equipment which is a great aid to spaceflight. I don't mean spaceships. What is it? Very good. The landing grid. It's a planetary-based construction which uses force fields to lift space vessels into orbit and bring them down from orbit. One point for the anti-Americans. Now for the Americans as they come roaring back. What early American SF magazine lasted just two issues?
Miracle Science and Fantasy Story.
Right. I'm nonpartisan, you understand. For the anti-Americans, how many letters of the English alphabet, as opposed to the American alphabet, can you think of which do not represent the first letter of a science fiction magazine title? Foreign language publications are excluded. British, Australian, American only. How many letters of the English alphabet can you think of which do not represent the first letter of a science fiction magazine title? One point for everyone you think of.
Y.
Y is fine.
Q.
Q seems to be good, too.
Y.
Y is fine.
U.
No. Universe science fiction. All right, we'll give you that as answered. You did get several. To the Americans, can you name the first editors of the following magazines? Amazing Stories.
You've
heard that. Very good. Fantasy and Science Fiction, or the magazine of fantasy in its first issue. Right. Startling Stories. Startling Stories with Mark Weisinger. Science Fantasy. Science Fantasy, first issue editor. Even I can answer this.
In the first magazine?
Yes.
Edward J. Carnell.
Walter Gilman. First two issues. Unknown.
J.W.C. Jr. He was junior then.
20 the USA.
20 the USA, I lost.
Thank you. before Gernsback, there was no fandom. Then came Amazing.
Away with the mundane and gaffia.
Away with the mundane and gaffia.
Darkness in active fandom.
Citizens who laid vile hands upon him seat of judgment along the Evesham Road, where a pyre had been prepared for Antony and his proscribed books. Roughly did they lash him to the stake and throw his books upon the pyre to feed the cruel flames. Brothers of the Sidereal Order, garbed to resemble local citizenry, did press through the unenlightened ceiling mob. Antony, perceiving the approach of his followers, did struggle in his bonds. The brothers, assembled round the pyre, did, of one accord, withdraw their observed flasks and pour the contents upon the flames. Alas, they were too late. Even their reserves were inadequate. Antony, crying in a loud voice, "Fear not, for ye true men. Drink of Andon's mead, ere thy flagons fail again," succumbed to the flames. And great out of iridescent liquid sprang from the earth, delivering the remnants of the tomes into the eager hand of his faithful followers. Whereupon the local citizenry, hearing of Antony's decree, did erect a pump room over the well, and did declare from that day forth the town should be known as Chapman's Spa, and be renowned for its healthful water. And it came to pass that word spread throughout the realm of the salubrious and erudicious powers of the Kent, and the populace did flock from near and afar to partake thereof. But only to the true fan did the mystic fire in the water become manifest, and it has remained so even unto this day.
You have heard the legend of St. Antony, and, mark you well, should not any fan here assembled before this dais pass the test and take the oath, surely he shall be stretched upon the skyrack and put to the floor. Verily, even as the legend foretells, only the true fan may taste of the spirit in the water from St. Antony's well. Therefore, let a goblet of spa water be brought, that its contents may be verified.
Truly, it is water from St. Antony's well.
Then let all these fen here assembled take the test.
Aye, the test.
They who drink ere the sword shall drop shall pay forfeit. Then drink deep of the water of St. Antony. Antony, say yea or nay.
Yea.
Then touch this sword as token of my
and the lady of St. Anthony.
Let them be given tokens that all here in this city of London shall beware their sword arms. Master of the Archives.
I don't call your name out, but it's not for the Grand Master. Harry Nadler. Rooms with rubber walls. They're
constantly expanding. There are three garages in which I don't think you could accommodate one of these horrible airy spiders which I have seen on sale in the streets of London, because the garages too are packed from floor to ceiling with science fiction and fantasy books and magazines. Altogether, there are 13 rooms, which at the time I left the United States about 60 days ago, had approximately 30,000 volumes of science fiction and fantasy in them. By the time I returned home, I think that will have increased to about 31,000, as I have been sending huge amounts of science fiction books and magazines back from Paris and Berlin and Switzerland and Yugoslavia and the many countries and cities that I've visited in the last 2 months. Now, I occasionally have a nightmare as to what would happen if 915 South Sherborne Drive should catch on fire, and I had the opportunity to save just one room out of the 13, which would it be? However, the choice is quite clear-cut when I think about films. In the last 65 years of motion pictures, there was a golden age which existed for a baker's dozen of years, 13 years I would say, from 1923 till approximately 1936. For about half of this time, the screen was silent and offered a great number of memorable motion pictures, and then in the latter half of these years, the screen found its voice and brought us Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi and Peter Lorre and Claude Rains, all gentlemen of distinction in the vocal department as well as their acting ability. It was only on this European trip within the last few weeks, as a matter of fact, that I finally saw one of the great science fiction films which I had been hearing of for 40 years. I had missed it last year in Trieste when, for the first time in many years, it was shown. This was a Russian film made in approximately 1923, which I had been mispronouncing all my life until I finally found it's called A Elita. When I was shown this at the Belgian Cinematheque in Brussels, I found that about 75% of the film was rather boring because it was of a mundane nature, dealing with Russian activities of about 40 years ago, but the remaining 25% I found really staggering even after 40 years in the visual concept. This was a story of primarily the planet Mars and its robotic civilization there, and a very exotic queen, and quite unlike miserable motion pictures like Cat Women of the Moon or the Queen of Outer Space, the civilization on Mars was extremely interesting in the Russian concept of it. There was a great deal of exotic alien visual beauty on the screen, and much imagination was exhibited. In the earliest days of this golden era of 13 years of science fiction and fantasy films, one which I saw as a youngster came from Italy, and this was the definitive version of Dante's Inferno. It was done years later on in America with Spencer Tracy, but the really fine version came from Italy, where two or three reels were devoted to an exciting visual trip through the lower levels of hell. Oddly enough, just as a footnote to this, the better portions of this Italian spectacle were used many years later on in a very cheap Main Street type of sex exploitation movie in America about an inventor who created a television machine which was able to tune in on hell itself. And this production was called Hellovision. In the year 1925, I believe, Germany sent us its masterpiece, Metropolis, and America made its masterpiece of Silent Dinosaurs, the adaptation of England's own Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, The Lost World. This is a film, well, both of these films were shown in the earliest days of science fiction conventions. I believe the first convention of all, 23 of them ago, in New York in 1939, there was a revival of The Lost World and also of Metropolis. Now, unfortunately, this convention ends at a late hour on Monday, so it will not be possible for me to speak to you about Metropolis other than to describe the first reel of it. As a number of you know, this is my greatest enthusiasm of all time. Of all the 40 years of science fiction and fantasy films that I have seen, I feel that Metropolis is the ultimate, and I've been asked several times privately in the last few days why I have such a high opinion of the picture. It was just about 2 weeks ago in Germany that I was shown one reel from it again, and I understand even a number of the Germans have not seen their own masterpiece, but this situation is going to be corrected in the near future because the film has now been re-edited. They have made an attempt to alter it from the original speed at which it was projected as a silent film and to show it in the talking era's speed. Sound has been added to it. New prints have been made, and it's going to be shown in England and America and Germany and generally revived all over the world. And I think that if you see it, even after 40 years, I've had this experience in Hollywood. I recently arranged for a showing of it, which George Pal and a number of other producers were present. I wanted them to look at it with an eye to possibly remaking Metropolis. They all threw up their hands in horror after they had seen it and said that this would cost $25 million to make by America's standards today. The reason I hold the film in such high regard is that I feel that frame by frame, no motion picture has ever been made in the science fiction or fantasy field which has such a concentration of imagination. Metropolis is a story of the 21st century and deals with a magnificent city of 60 million population. It could very well have been treated strictly as science fiction of the nature of H.G. Wells' Things to Come, but for whatever reasons, the authors of the script, Teofan Harbou, who died in 1956, and Fritz Lang, the director, who was about to celebrate his 75th birthday, and Manuel Günther Rittau, whom I met several weeks ago in Munich, the man who made the special effects in it, all these people combined to make not only a science fiction film masterpiece, but they packed into it a huge amount of wonderful visual fantasy. I think they were under the influence of some of the earlier pictures they had made, such as Siegfried, and they have surrealistic scenes and fever dreams, and the figure of death itself coming to life, and the building of the Tower of Babel, and montages of hundreds of eyes and human beings on the screen. They had to do it in the difficult way in the early days. They didn't have the optical illusionary effects that are possible in the modern laboratories, but sometimes had to run the film through the camera as high as 26 times to get a single effect, which lasted just a matter of moments on the screen. Well, in the 1 year, 1925, I personally was greatly influenced in the fantasy film field by seeing two of the masterpieces, which swung the pendulum in both directions. First, there was The Lost World, which went millions of years into the past, showed a total of 49 different dinosaurs on the screen during the projection of the entire picture. Some of these sequences are lost as we see them nowadays. And then Metropolis, which went approximately 100 years into the future. Also, in this silent era, the greatest portrayer of fantastic characterizations who ever lived, Lon Chaney Sr., the man who won the reputation of the Man of a Thousand Faces, he was busy year after year turning out masterpieces which survive and are seen and appreciated to this day. He was so appreciated, as a matter of fact, that several years ago when Universal Studios, who had used his services while he was alive and came to their golden anniversary, I believe it was, they chose to tell the story of the life of Lon Chaney as their number one picture of the year, calling it The Man of a Thousand Faces. And Lon Chaney, in the silent era, gave us these masterpieces which, as they survive to this day, such as The Phantom of the Opera, which I think, as far as silent fantastic films goes, has the undisputed number one top terror scene of all time, when the young lady Mary Philbin crept up behind the masked figure of Eric, who was deep underground under the opera in Paris, and removed the mask from his face, and he turned around, and all of America, myself included, gasped and practically fainted 40 years ago when they saw this horrifying visage of utter evil incarnate. Lon Chaney also did the great original characterization of Quasimodo, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and through the silent years up until the time of his death, made one memorable characterization after another. He played a dual role, one of which was a kind of combination vampire and ghoul in the film London After Midnight, and he played an ape man and a maniacal doctor and a man without arms and without legs, and contorted himself into just about every imaginable and unimaginable position that a human being could twist himself into. In the silent years, a memorable version of the Thief of Baghdad was made with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. This is another film which is packed full of fantasy, being an Arabian Night story. We saw a flying carpet. There was a magic apple which could bring people back to life after they had been poisoned by a deadly snake. There was a series of trials that the hero had to go through, going through a mountain of fire and going under the sea and fighting a gigantic spider. There was a wonderful winged horse on which he flew to the moon, and there he found some magic powder which he had only to throw on the ground and make a wish, and any wish came true. There was early invisibility in that picture with the cloak of invisibility that he found there. And The Thief of Baghdad, packed as it was with all these fantastic visual delights, was somewhat duplicated in Germany when they sent over Siegfried, a story which also had its invisibility element, and statues which came to life turned into human beings, a kind of ghostly effect of a semi-visible Siegfried, a mountain of fire, and between the two, each of these films had fire-breathing dragons. Now, they did it the easy way in The Thief of Baghdad. I frankly didn't realize it at the time. When I saw it at the age of 12 or 14, I thoroughly believed in that dragon. Many years later on, when I saw it, I was quite disenchanted to find that it was merely an alligator with some fins stuck onto it, but it made a lasting impression on me as a youth. However, in Siegfried, they did it the hard way. The Germans very methodically built a giant dragon about the size of a small Zeppelin and had a dozen people inside it operating it, and much was made of this matter with Hugo Gernsback's magazine Science and Invention giving all the inside story on the production. In 1927, in Hugo Gernsback's Science and Invention magazine, there was one page devoted to a long since forgotten film. Sometimes I think I must be the only individual left in the world who realizes there ever was a picture variously called in this country Our Heavenly Bodies, and in European countries, it was, whatever they call it, it always translated into wonders of creation or wonders of the universe. There was a full page describing this picture in Gernsback's pre-amazing days, and it included about half a dozen photographs showing a great city of the future with what they called an ether ship leaving for a trip around the solar system. It showed a scene rather familiar to us now from much later films, such as The Woman in the Moon and Destination Moon and Rocket Ship Expedition Moon, Conquest of Space, and so on, and what we have now actually seen in reality. But 40 years ago, we had one of the earliest scenes of this nature in a film showing three astronauts upside down inside the spaceship. This picture, Our Heavenly Bodies, was a story of a trip around the entire solar system with stops on the Moon and Mars, with a good look at the rugged surface of Jupiter and of Saturn. And I have wondered volubly during the last decade or so, whatever became of this picture, why it is not referred to by historians. I finally, in West Berlin last month, inside of 2 minutes with this great German efficiency, they laid in my hands at a kind of state library that I was visiting, a very fine, exciting, visual, eight-page souvenir about the film. Yeah, I'm really more puzzled than ever now because I find it was an UFA production, the UFA studios, the same people who made Metropolis, Girl on the Moon, Spies, Siegfried, and so on. It was made within 1 year of Metropolis. It had one of the principal players from Metropolis in it, and also a woman who had appeared in Siegfried. So it seems that this picture would be known and remembered and referred to, and so on. Now, I'm told that in East Berlin, they have the world's number one film archives, and they have 42,000 films there, and among them is this picture, Our Heavenly Bodies. Now, whether it would be possible to get a copy over the wall and out to the rest of the world to look at, I don't know. It's a fond dream of mine to finally see that picture. Still in the silent days, there was an adaptation made of A. Merritt's book, Seven Footprints to Satan. I saw this as a youngster, and as I recall it, after 35 years or so, I found it quite interesting, but the legend is that when the author saw the film, he actually wept. He was so disappointed in what they had done to Seven Footprints to Satan. The feeling through the years is that this must one day be remade as a talking picture. There were very high hopes that Sidney Greenstreet would take the role of Satan at one time. Later on, as Peter Lorre began to blow up like a blimp, he became a possibility for the role. At present time, the thinking is that Orson Welles would be excellent, or even we are attempting, a number of us in America, to get one of our favorite authors, Fritz Leiber, out of the pages of magazines and books and onto the screen. At the age of about 55, those of us who know Fritz personally are convinced that there are about 20 great years ahead of him when Karloff and Carradine and Basil Rathbone and the final remaining few who have specialized in fantasy films through the years, when they are gone, and there's really no one, no attempt is being made for any replacement for these remarkable men, and Hollywood would only wake up to the fact that right under its nose it has a man of magnificent stature and one of these incredible, memorable voices. When I left Hollywood to go a little bit away from the subject matter of the talk and into future possibilities, I left Fritz Leiber with the phone number of a producer who was very interested in having him appear in an original science fiction film. He known as Equinox. And also, I've been successful after 20 years in selling to Hollywood a book called Deliver Me from Eva. This was an obscure book by an unknown author that I just happened to become fond of about half my life ago. And I had bought duplicate copies of it at every opportunity and given it to producers without avail for 20 years until finally a producer called me about 2 months ago and said, you know, that book you gave me 2 years ago, well, I got around to reading it. We're very excited about it. Instead of Deliver Me from Eva, we want to call it Cadaver. And we have the star for it. We want to try to find Gail Sondergaard, who played the Spider Woman many years ago, and bring her back onto the screen. And so they were ready, willing, and able to talk contract. At this point, actually, it threw me into a kind of a panic because I had never known the author in the first place. It was all 20 years in the past. For all I knew, he might have been killed in World War II, or he could have been anywhere in the world at this point if he were alive. And I had just gone through 6 months of this sort of thing over 7 footprints to Satan. There was a studio that wished to produce it. A Merritt, of course, was long dead, but I had believed originally that I knew where his widow was. But finally, a 6 month search failed to produce Mrs. Merritt. The studio had even gone to the extent of calling in our kind of local equivalent of Scotland Yard. We had a Pinkerton detective agency in America who guarantees to follow a person to Pellucidar if necessary to produce them, find them anywhere in the world or out of it. And in the end, I did find Mrs. Merritt under rather enigmatic circumstances. She was no longer in Miami, where I had believed, but was in a hospital in New York. And all I got out of her at the time was a signature evidencing that somewhere along the line she had remarried, as she now had a different last name. And the signature began to peter out right in the middle of it. It was now some new long name, and I didn't, it was impossible to say just what was happening. She was simply on a pink slip that I received from the post office giving evidence that she had received my inquiry about the film. But, hey, the signature right in the middle of it began to dwindle away, and I didn't know whether simply her ballpoint pen had given out or whether Mrs. Merritt had given out, since this was coming from a hospital. Well, it was just a temporary situation with her. As far as I know, she is alive and well, and negotiations are still going on for the production of 7 Footprints to Satan. But since I'd had 6 months of this sort of difficulty finding her, I thought, oh, here we go again. Now Hollywood wants to make a movie out of Deliver Me from Eva, but are we ever going to be able to produce the author? And so I did the most unlikely thing in the world. I simply reached out and picked up the local Los Angeles phone book, found three authors, didn't know whether they were authors, three men named Bailey in the local phone book. For some reason or other, the name in the middle appealed to me. I dialed that, was busy. I tried the Bailey on either side, no response. Went back to the original Paul Bailey, and now a woman's voice came on the phone, and I thought, well, I wonder how many women I will talk to in the next year in every city and state in the United States, trying to find out if their husband ever wrote a book called Deliver Me from Eva. But when this woman very promptly said, why, yes, Paul wrote that about 20 years ago, I think I hit a high C well above anything that Eva Sumac ever sang. I was so delighted and excited, and there's a little causal to this story that developed when I finally talked with the author himself and told him how, unbeknownst to him, for 20 years I had been keeping his Eva alive with potential motion picture producers, and he had not been aware of my existence during all this time. And it developed that in Los Angeles, Angeles, he lived just two blocks away from a street I didn't know existed called Ackerman Drive. Nearly Ackerman Drive had been working for him for 20 years without his knowing it. Well, I got well away from the subject matter of this talk. We're still in the silent era, theoretically, with a few more films to cover. One of which was called One Glorious Day, and was one of the earliest films which employed ghostly trick effects. This was about a little boy named Eck, E-C-K, who was kicked out of heaven as he was too much of a mischief maker, and he came down a tremendous spiral slide at the beginning of the film, and for the rest of the picture was a mischievous little imp who was annoying the late Will Rogers. As films began to find their voice, there was a great version made of Jules Verne's Mysterious Island. Dakar, in this picture, was played by the late Lionel Barrymore. The film was in so-called Technicolor, in the earliest days of Technicolor. It was not much more than a rather annoying combination of green, orange, and brown. But the film itself, which had a complete sound score and some moments of talking in it, was a really outstanding version of the Mysterious Island. It was actually combined the two books, The 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Mysterious Island. And since it is a totally impromptu speech, I'm just going to throw in a thought at this point that Captain Nemo is not dead, and the Nautilus is to return via Ray Bradbury's hand. Bradbury has received a contract from one of the leading publishers of America to write a third story, making a trilogy out of the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea works. I have every reason to believe that this will be done with tender, loving care, because Bradbury himself has reread the works of Jules Verne and is very enthusiastic about them and is very happy to talk to audiences about them. He feels that Jules Verne had an element which has been lacking in some of the later science fiction, that Verne is very much of an optimist, that he held high ideals and hopes for humanity, as was demonstrated, for instance, in his story of Rover the Conqueror. In the days when sound was coming into science fiction films, the Germans sent us the Frau Mond, variously known as Rocket to the Moon, Girl of the Moon, and Woman in the Moon, a film which is still quite visually exciting today. It had been missing from America for many years, but finally a print became available several years ago and was shown at the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society, one of the first showings in America, and is now available actually to private collectors. And England itself made either the first or the second talking film, devoting itself to the future. This was a film with Benita Hume, who later on married the late Ronald Colman. She was the star of the picture with a man long dead named Jameson Thomas. This was a film which came to America in 1930 and was called High Treason. As a story of what was then 10 years in the future, 1940. Although as I look at stills of it today in the press book, I see even in 1965 we have still not caught up to some of the concepts which the British created in High Treason. It's a story of a world on the verge of a second war. And in this picture, particularly recall that video telephones were in use in 1940, and that the facade of London had considerably changed. And this was a time in technology when we believed that we would be having perhaps floating platforms in the ocean, because at that time it's not conceived that we'd be able to fly completely over the ocean in a non-stop trip, where it was thought that about 200 miles, then you'd have to set down in an artificial island of steel and glass. As a matter of fact, Kurtz the Audubon wrote a book on just that subject matter, and this was filmed as a collaboration between the British and the Germans called Floating Platform Number 1 Does Not Reply. But returning to this high treason, they had the video phones in use in 1940, and we still don't really have those commercially in 1965. They also had a channel tunnel connecting France and England, which still doesn't exist. About 10 to 5, well, it was 1935, years later, here in England, they made a sort of a sequel to High Treason called Transatlantic Tunnel, which was a remake of an early German film. And in this picture, they carried on some of the ideas of High Treason and actually now had a tunnel built between London and New York. In the early 30s, Boris Karloff, a man who we find really had been on the screen for 10 years or more, but in such small parts that he hardly recognized, the best part he had had previous to Frankenstein was in a film called The Bells, which as we look at it today, we see has kind of echoes of the cabinet of Dr. Caligari in it. I'm now reminded of a number of silent films that I overlooked, some of the great classics of all time, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari with Conrad Veidt, the two versions of The Golem with a wonderful character actor, Paul Wegener of Germany, and Brigitte Helm, who had played the robot in Metropolis, made first a silent and then shortly thereafter a sound version of a film called Mondragora Al Rauna, which was about an artificial woman who was soulless and completely inhuman and ruthless. Conrad Veidt made a film called The Hands of Orlok, in which he was a pianist whose hands were smashed in an automobile wreck, and they were replaced by the hands of a murderer. The hands themselves had kind of an independent life and took over and began strangling and throwing knives and so on. This was later remade as Peter Lorre's first American film. The Hands of Orlok was called Mad Love. At that time, I recall in the trailer, the preview, a little enticement that they show in America to bring into the film next week, that Charles Chaplin, who was held in very high regard at that time, made the statement that he felt that when people saw this picture, Mad Love, they would recognize that Peter Lorre was the great new talent in motion pictures, and he was destined to be one of the number one personalities on the screen. Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi established reputations for themselves at the end of 1931 and the beginning of 1932. Their roles might very well have been reversed. Bela Lugosi actually had far greater stature than Karloff at the time, as he had appeared on the stage in over 1,000 performances of Dracula, and he was offered the role of the Frankenstein monster, as apparently were half the other actors in Hollywood at that time. I recently interviewed John Carradine, and he gave me to understand that he had been offered the role. Karloff, the truck driver at that time, became the Frankenstein monster and went on to a great number of other successes in The Black Cat and The Raven. And then there was a remarkable film, The Invisible Man, in which Claude Rains played the entire film without ever being seen. It was just his voice that established him immediately as a star. Boris Karloff came back here to London in about 1933 to make The Ghoul with the late Sir Cedric Hardwicke. The 5 years from 1930 to 1935 were just packed with pieces, which still thrill the world of its day, particularly in America, when seen on television. Charles Lawton made H.G. Wells' Island of Lost Souls, which oddly enough was forbidden, I believe, in this country until very recently. It was one of the certificate X pictures. I've been given a little note here that we're running out of time, so I think I could be possible for me to talk to you individually or write about this golden 13 years. I'll call that to a halt and just very quickly to tell you about some of the brand new exciting things we can look forward to in the next year. They've just completed a $6.5 million production in America of an original script called Fantastic Voyage, which very briefly is about a number of people and submarine itself, which is shrunken to almost microscopic size due to the necessity to operate on an otherwise inoperable tumor in the brain of a very important world figure. And the entire film, which is in widescreen and Technicolor, consists of all the adventures of the submarine after it's injected into a vein of this man and travels through the whole human system, and finally the operation is made on the tumor. This is successful. The man is, when he is brought out of his coma and told that he will live, he has several tears of gratitude, and the submarine comes out of one of the tears, and everybody is brought back to their proper side. I think we will be seeing Fritz Leiber on the screen within the next year or two. I myself play a little fun role as the assistant to Basil Rathbone in a film which was made under the respectable title A Flight to a Far Planet, but I'm afraid will be released under the rather cringeful title of Planet of Blood. There will also be a sequel to this in which I probably will not appear, as I think it was shot while I was away from Hollywood. Perhaps that will keep me from being shot when I return there, because I didn't appear in it. And Arthur C. Clarke has collaborated with Stanley Kramer, a very highly respected name in motion pictures. Between the two of them, they are working on a product which will be called Journey Beyond the Stars. It will start at the beginning of the next century and will be kind of a Cook's tour of the universe. George Pal has bought Dr. W. Olaf Stapledon's great classic, Odd John. This is being turned into a screenplay by Ray Russell, whose Zots opened the convention yesterday. Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood End is to be produced at the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios by George Pal. And last but not least, Ray Bradbury has spent 6 months at Universal Studios turning his own Martian Chronicles into a 1,000-page shooting script, which of course he himself realized would mean a film that we would all have the pleasure of going to the theater at 6 o'clock on a Monday morning and coming out with bloodshot eyeballs at midnight the following Saturday. So he has carefully cut that down to 175 pages, which will only take 3 hours to be projected in Cinerama at a cost equaling that of Spartacus of $12 million. We now seem to be entering into a very expensive spectacle era of science fiction. The Italians are doing one of Robert Sheckley's stories from Galaxy, the 7th or 10th victim, they're calling it, and they have bought this highly controversial Barbarella strip. I use that in both senses of the word. It's kind of a Flash Gordon female form of striptease, which is to be produced in Italy. But I look forward very much to the Trieste Science Fiction Film Festival in years to come. I think that they will again have something respectable and exciting to show to the public.